The Packers have problems. How much of the blame falls on Aaron Rodgers? Can the Seahawks grind out another win in Carolina? And lots of talk about the Rams-Chiefs game. Why the defense was a lot more important than you think and what it all means for the future of football. It's all on the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. We apologize for coming one day late to you, but hopefully you were celebrating Thanksgiving, or if you don't celebrate Thanksgiving, just watching football on Thursday. But we are here. We are previewing some of the big Week 12 games. We are also going to talk about, since it happened after we did the Monday podcast, since we tape on Sunday nights, we're going to talk about that Chiefs-Rams game and then sort of the implications on football as a whole. But Andy, let's jump to Week 12 here with Packers Vikings. These are offensive teams in crisis, I feel like.
Really? In crisis?
Crisis. Well, maybe not quite crisis. Problematic offensive performances last week for both these teams. And I guess let's start on the Packers side of the ball. All the heat's on McCarthy right now. Everyone's sort of talking like it's a foregone conclusion that he will be out at the end of this year. I will simply point out they have an incredibly soft schedule down the stretch. This game is not part of that really soft schedule, but they could very easily end up losing this game and still getting to 9 wins. They win this game, they can get to 10 wins, etc., and make the postseason. But the offense is stale. It's stagnant. It's problematic. And I just kind of pose to you, what can they do at this point? What can Mike McCarthy do with this offense in, you know, week 12 of the 2018 season?
I'm just going to be blunter than I usually would be here because we've got to cut through this conversation. Here's what the deal is with Green Bay's. Their offense, and I'm not a big McCarthy defender. I think people would know that from listening to the show over the years. But their offense is not stale right now. That's a narrative that's being pushed. And the other thing that nobody talks about is, for whatever reason, Aaron Rodgers is treated like a god, and you can never say anything negative about him, and everything he does is absolutely perfect, and if it's not going well, then it's not him, it's everybody around him, and especially his coach. Here's what's true about Green Bay's offense. They've totally changed their formationing and have expanded their route concepts out of it. They don't spread out anymore. They've gone to more condensed formations, like what the Rams do. Their numbers there are, I had my guy Alan Oy, my film helper, chart this. Their numbers of spread are way down. Their numbers of condensed formations are way up. And they're running good route combinations off of it. So that's part A. Part B is, and we've talked about this before, but it's been really bad in some games. The Miami game is the one that really stands out. Every week you put on film and you see Aaron Rodgers leaving throws on the field. And what that does is create the illusion of an offense not working. Oh, the ball's not coming out. No one's getting open. Guys are getting open. The quarterback doesn't always throw it. And the results are still good more often than not because Rodgers is a tremendous talent. But we've got to get past this Aaron Rodgers is king of the world thought, because there are about 5 or 6 quarterbacks in the league right now who are clearly playing better than him. And I don't think they're running a bad offense. I think they're an offense that runs their offense inconsistently.
Interesting. So we did not discuss the Thursday night game that they lost in Seattle because it was Thursday night, and then we only cover the Sunday games on the Monday show. I agree with you on Rodgers. He made 2 spectacular throws, 2 jaw-dropping throws. The scramble touchdown in the first half to the tight end none of us had heard of before that. I had actually only heard about him because Kalen Kaler wrote about him in August. The deep ball to Devontae Adams where he just threw an absolute rainbow that dropped in perfectly. He left a lot of throws on the field, and he left a lot of throws on the field, check down throws on 3rd and short. They were something like 2 for 8 on 3rd and 5 or less, and I'd say on about half of those non-conversions, they could have been converted quite easily.
And that's what he was doing in the Miami game as well. There was one instance in that game, it was a 4th and 2, And the Packers put Davante Adams at running back, and they did that strictly to get him matched up. I believe it must have been on a linebacker because Miami only plays nickel defense. I forget which linebacker it was, but that's not the point. They got their number one receiver matched on a linebacker. Adams ran an angle route, got open right on schedule. Rodgers didn't throw the ball. If you have a QB that's not going to throw the ball on a 4th and 2 where your number one receiver's in the backfield because the play is so heavily designed for him, then I don't know what you're supposed to do if you're Mike McCarthy. And what I would really love to know is what their personal relationship is like when they get in the film room and they all see this or watching film as an offense and they see this superstar QB not running the offense on schedule. What do they say to Rodgers in that moment? What does he say back to them? Because it happens with regularity now, and I think it's happened lately. It's happened with Rodgers a little bit more than it has in other times. What's also so interesting is I've seen this before, and Rodgers can flip a switch at any moment and be as on schedule as Drew Brees or Tom Brady. I mean, he could do that. He could come out tomorrow and play that way. So he's the most bizarre, fascinating, mercurial QB I've ever seen, Gary.
I want to make 2 points here. First of all, there was a play in that Packers game, and I wrote about this in my Sunday column, Sunday morning column last week. Tremendous play. They started with Adams lined up directly behind Rodgers in a pistol formation, motioned Adams into the slot, ended up getting Adams on an over route where he was matched up on Bobby Wagner. I thought the throw was fine. There was lots of margin for error. Wagner clearly interfered with Adams. For some reason, there was no flag on the play, but that was another big play in that game that might have swung that one. And if obviously the Packers win that game, we have different discussion. The other point I'd make with the Packers as a whole and whether they are falling apart here, they had to go 2 time zones on a Thursday night. We have seen how many teams struggle when they are forced to go on the road for Thursday night football. That was not the Packers' case. They did show up ready to play in this game. It got away from them for reasons that we've just discussed a little bit. But overall, it seems like Aaron Rodgers, and again, we're not in the quarterback's room. We're not watching film of these guys. We don't have a great read because Rodgers and McCarthy have not really said anything publicly to disclose anything about their relationship. We at the MMQB are working very hard to get some sort of feel for their relationship. It seems like Rodgers just doesn't like the offense. I mean, is there something said for that? This is not the offense he wants to run.
Well, I've heard the reason. Remember, Tom Clements called the plays a few years ago. McCarthy took back the play calling duties. I've heard the reason for that was Rodgers didn't like the offense under Clements, and he was checking in and out of too many plays, and basically the play caller was becoming irrelevant and Rodgers was running the game. And so they found McCarthy to get some authority back and probably a little bit more rapport between play caller and QB. That's what I heard. The other thing I've heard about Rodgers and why some of this stuff, why he's so inconsistent on his timing within the offense, is he's got a memory like an elephant. And if there are snaps where it's say on that Adams play, for example, if you ask Rodgers, why didn't you throw it? He might realistically say, well, 12 years ago, we played the Ravens and their backup linebacker and Suggs ran a zone exchange and Suggs almost intercepted it. I was worried that the Dolphins right here might do that zone exchange and just made me pause. He's got, apparently that's how he functions, I've heard, which he must not function like that all the time, because you wouldn't function. He certainly wouldn't be a superstar quarterback, but I've heard that he remembers a lot of the bad things that have happened to him bad plays and the details of them, and he takes those into consideration at times where maybe it's not appropriate. I don't know this for certain because I haven't asked Rodgers and I haven't sat with him, but that's what I've heard from talking to people around the Packers organization over the years.
I mean, it would kind of make sense. He used to talk to Peter King a lot. Obviously, he talked about avoiding turnovers, and you know, he puts so much of an emphasis on that in his game. And obviously, he is a guy who avoids turnovers, but he's also a guy. I mean, how many times over the course of a game does he, you know, basically throw at a defender's ear hole? Those are throws that a risk-averse quarterback does not normally make.
Right.
So I guess he's just. It's just a matter of just verifying the coverage so much.
Right. I was going to say, you almost say he sounds like a see it passer, a guy that's got to see it and then pull the trigger. But I know he's not that because I've seen him make too many good anticipation throws. He is fascinating, Gary. Utterly fascinating. And what's a real shame is it feels like we're not allowed to analyze it. Because if you say any of this stuff about Rodgers on Twitter, you're just a hater. And if you bring it up, Green Bay radio, they'll have the conversation. But for whatever reason, it doesn't stick. It doesn't hold. It never comes up in the broadcasts. There's this perception that Aaron Rodgers is a flawless QB, when in fact Rodgers is a very flawed QB in a fascinating way. And it doesn't mean he's not a great QB still. Yeah. He is very great.
His highs are so incredibly high, I think, is what it comes down to. I mean,
yeah,
that's what people,
I would agree.
You know, most people aren't grading quarterbacks. Most people don't see every throw a quarterback makes over a 16-game season. So, you know, you take away the highlights, and obviously, you know, the highlights he has are just, they're mind-blowing, what he's able to do physically. Let's look at the other side of the ball real quick. There's one thing I want to talk about with this Vikings offense, and apparently Mike Zimmer is seemingly a little bit unhappy, and understandably so, considering the performance Sunday night in Chicago in a game where they didn't need to have it, but it would have been really nice to have. They, you know, we talked on the Monday show. They didn't run tempo. We thought maybe they should have run a little more tempo, especially once they fell behind at halftime. I want to ask you one thing. Why aren't the Vikings running more play action? And I don't want to – I don't – John DeFilippo is a better offense coordinator than I would be. It feels like, since the Vikings were so successful running play action a year ago with Case Keenum, and they brought in a quarterback who was so successful running play action in Washington, there's some like 20% of their throws come off play action this year, which is I believe bottom 12 in the league. It just feels like this should be a team that is running play action constantly.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't have a concise answer for you. They have had games where the running game was a complete afterthought. And I think DeFilippo and Mike Zimmer have had a little bit of a tug of war about that, as Zimmer wants to be a run team and DeFilippo's a creative passing mind. He does a lot with route concepts, I think, and I'm not saying these are his motives at all, but he's a quality head coaching candidate, and everyone around the league knows that it's what you do in the passing game that gets you a coaching job. So it's just a passing league, and DeFilippo's at the forefront of it. And how do you find the balance between pleasing the defensive-minded head coach and running the ball? And by the way, your top running back's been out for much of the season, and Dalvin Cook, and your interior O-line's been a little bit inconsistent here and there. It's just a team that doesn't have a run game identity fully fledged out yet, and I would imagine that would impact your play-action game.
All right. I would think that's something we'll see more of on Sunday night, but we'll find out. And yeah, well, the Vikings are 21st in play action percentage here, according to Football Outsiders.
The one thing about that, Green Bay does so many matchup coverage concepts. You tend to do play action more against zone teams because you want the defenders with their eyes on the action so they can react to the fake. Play action versus man-to-man isn't always as lucrative. So we'll find out. And what's interesting about Green Bay is they play man outside, and then their inside defenders often play zone, so which is where play action usually attacks, linebackers and safety. So, yeah, we very well could see it, but if we don't, my guess is it's because they're running man-beater stuff.
All right, let's go to Denver for the second game here. This is Steelers at Broncos. Let's just talk about the Broncos real quick here. Defensively, this is a team that I don't want to say we gave up on them. That would be maybe a good thing for them, considering the teams we've given up on and then gone on big runs, and then we've gotten on their bandwagon and then they've fallen off this year. But the Broncos have looked better. I mean, they're coming off an upset win at Los Angeles, a game that a lot of people didn't think they would get. They are still, you know, in the playoff hunt at this point. Are we, based on, you know, the ugly loss at the Jets, I mean, do we have to reassess this team, specifically this defense, who we kind of said, well, I guess they're just not what they used to be?
Well, and our outline that you send me for this show, Gary, so that we have a semblance of preparation behind it, you wrote here, let's see, Steelers Broncos, parentheses, are Broncos for real?
That's my
question.
And
I would say, well, I get, what are they, 4-6? I guess it's real. I mean, what do you mean by are they for real? You tend to ask that when a team's down 8-2 and on a 5-game winning streak. Are the 4-6 Broncos for real? Yeah, they feel like about a 4-6 team to me. I guess they're real.
But we were, I mean, look, they got blown out by the Jets.
That
and, you know,
was real.
They got blown out by the Jets. They lost at home to Houston. They, you know, this is a team that has had some bad. They got blown out by the Ravens in Baltimore. You know, this is a team that has had some bad weeks this year. And that is shorthand, by the way, Andy. Are the Broncos for real?
So when you're asking, are they for real? You're saying, are they really this? I guess I don't know what we're asking because they're at 4-6. They're both good and bad. That's how you get to be about 500. So what's real?
Stop looking at the outline, Andy. What's the deal with their defense? Are they going to be a dominating defense again? That is my question. We sort of have said the last 2 years, are the Broncos going to be back where they were in 2015? They'll probably never be back to where they were in 2015, but can they approach that and be a team that has a good enough defense to, one might say, Jaguars style, make a run?
Oh, here we go. So I get the sense that you feel I'm seeing the trees and not the forest in your outline question of whether the Broncos are for real.
I just want to point out the outline I just jotted down. That wasn't really the question I was preparing to ask you.
Okay. You know what I think their defense comes down to a lot? Two things. Let's put three, and let's touch on the third one real quick, actually. They should be a really good run defense every single week. And there have been weeks this year where they have not been good. And I don't have any explanation for that because individually they have very good run defenders. Their linebackers lately, even with Josie Jewell in there for an injured Brandon Marshall, they've been very assertive in hitting run gaps. And so it has been a better run defense, but that hasn't been the case every week this year. So that's been surprising. Let's assume that going into a given game, they're going to stop the run because of all the talent they have in the front seven. That leaves the other two things. Is their safety play, which can be up and down at times. Justin Simmons, his awareness wavers. I think sometimes it's great. Other times you wonder what he's doing out there. And number two corner, Bradley Roby, who's similar to Simmons in that he's up and down. And when Roby's playing well, and we're talking man coverage now, which is what most of Denver's coverages wind up being. It's a matchup defense. When Roby's playing well, this defense really hums. When he struggles, the defense has a reactionary feel to it. Roby, and I think he's in a contract year. He's going to be a really interesting guy to see what kind of second contract he gets offered because the talent's there. He can do what you want, but he's part of the reason we don't know what this defense is from week to week.
All right. Well, they got a test for the Steelers here. I don't know. Do we need to discuss anything? Steelers pass rush is really rising fast at this point. I think that we wondered about that defense early in the year. That pass rush has become, I don't say dominant, but that has become a B+ to A- type of pass rush. And I feel like that's really settled them as far as the defensive side of the ball goes.
Well, and you know what they're doing really well? Their linebackers are disguising and timing their blitzes exceptionally well. They've gotten very comfortable with their blitz angles, and this takes an entire front seven effort. This isn't just John Bostic at linebacker or Vince Williams at linebacker making plays. It's those guys plus the men around them creating the spacing and the illusions and everything that goes into it. They've been great at that. I would imagine we'll see a lot of that on Sunday because Case Keenum's not the tallest QB, and Denver's got three new basically backup interior starters in there because of injuries to their other interior offensive linemen. So going right up the middle against this Broncos offense, that's the approach. And I think we'll see the Steelers do it quite a bit. And that doesn't even get to the question of whether Garrett Bowles and Jared Valdir can block Bud Dupree and TJ Watt on the edges.
Yeah, this is a. I feel like this is a particularly good matchup for the Steelers. They've been a little bit up and down on the road over the years, but you know, when they hosted the Vikings early last year, and granted this was very soon after Sam Bradford had gotten hurt and Keenum had gone in, and we didn't know Keenum was going to do what Keenum did last year, but they beat this Vikings team fairly handily in Pittsburgh a year ago. I shouldn't say this Vikings team. They beat Keenum's team pretty handily in Pittsburgh a year ago, and now they get Keenum's new team on the road here. Seahawks and Panthers. Let's do one more here, Andy. I guess the question in this one is, you know, this Panthers run defense has been a little bit up and down, and now they face a team that has really, I want to say revitalized itself this year, the Seahawks offense, with a run game that they just haven't had since basically Marshawn Lynch was there.
They have, and Carolina's run defense was not, it was inconsistent against Detroit, which is hard to understand because very, very much like Denver, they have a lot of talent in that front seven there. I love the way Seattle's played football this year. It's outdated. It's not the stuff that comes up on Thursday Night Football and we go crazy about and talk for days and days. It's seemingly outdated. It's old school smash mouth running the ball. But it's the best way to play with Russell Wilson, and it's the best way to play with that offensive line that they have. And it's a totally different style of running game, too. With Tom Cable as their O-line coach a few years ago, last year and then preceding years, they were an outside zone running team. So that old Denver Broncos style of blocking. They're not that at all anymore, which is probably why Cable's not there. It's now Mike Solari is the offensive line coach and coordinator Brian Schottenheimer, and it's been more gap scheme and man-to-man and highly structured run blocking plays. And to a man, everybody on that offensive line has responded well and played better.
That'll be a good one. And Panthers kind of need to grab that one before before they sort of fall back to the pack in the NFC wildcard race. But
Gary, Seattle wins. Seattle will be 6-5 with the tiebreaker over Carolina. So this is a huge game for play because Carolina's playing for a wild card most likely. I know they've got the Saints twice, but what are they, three games back of the Saints right now, and the Saints are rolling. So it's wild card contention we're talking about, and Seattle would be 6-5, and Carolina would be 6-5 if the Seahawks win this game.
Yeah, Seahawks, they also still have they have two against San Francisco. They host Arizona. Their other games are their home, although they're against the Vikings and the Chiefs. So, this is a big one. I hate to sound like I'm writing off the Seahawks because I'm not. It just feels like they're playing at their ceiling at this point, and we'll see. We'll see if that gets them there. And it's kind of a nice transition to the mailbag here because we just talked about the Seahawks and how it's sort of an old school approach they're using. A lot of you wrote in about the Chiefs Rams Monday night game, which obviously we did not have a chance to cover in our podcast that comes out on Monday morning because the game hadn't happened yet. It was a ton of points, and the basic question, the most common question we got, and I'm going to leave this very open for you, Andy, and I'll let you riff, but was that game good for football? If this is a sign of what football's future will be?
Yes, absolutely. That game was offense played at its finest, with big-time defensive plays sprinkled in. Everybody's talking about this game as if it was just a shootout and, oh, where's the defense in today's NFL? How many games have we seen that have had three defensive touchdowns? What were the forced turnovers? Like six, seven, eight turnovers overall? Eight combined sacks?
Five to two in turnovers?
5-2 in turnover battle. And then eight sacks or so. I mean, when was the last time that happened? If these offenses, and I know this is ridiculous to say, but let's say these offenses that had a relatively good, not spectacular night, and they'd scored around 28 points or so each, we'd be talking about the big plays from this defensive battle and how that decided. And by the way, that very well did decide the game, very well could have. It was turnovers, and we talked about that going in, Gary, is the bend but don't break stuff's not going to work against these new age offenses. You've got to make big plays. And we said Justin Houston and D4, that could be a problem for the Rams. And we said the Rams pass rush with Aaron Donald inside could maybe get the Chiefs to play off schedule, and you never know how that results in interceptions. Both of those things came exactly true. This is football and the direction it's going. It was enthralling. I don't love 50-50 every week of the scores, but to see all these big defensive plays, I'm surprised that's getting overlooked the way it is.
Yeah, I think people do sort of lose track of the fact that, one, this was an extreme. This is two of the top three offenses in football playing against two, let's call them bottom 10 defenses, certainly below average defenses, with a couple of superstars sprinkled into them. But yeah, look, the score was 54-51 in part because you had three defensive touchdowns in the game, and that tends to, turnovers and short fields and those sorts of things tend to be what push scores up. So people, yes, right. 105 points are a lot of points. The offenses were incredible in this game, but the defenses made plays too, and without Aaron Donald, the Rams maybe lose this game by two or three touchdowns. He made enough plays to sort of swing it the other way. Lots of guys made plays, but we've talked about on this show, the game is now built for the aggressors. You're seeing it on offense more and more. I thought it took too long for teams to start taking this type of tack when it comes to the fact that the rules just are so heavily skewed towards the offense and the talent. We talk about reactionary, we talk a lot about how teams can't block. Offensive linemen are overwhelmed by the defensive linemen. Well, the receivers are a lot better than the defensive backs at this point. And you saw that on Monday. That's not just that game. It's typical of most games. The guys catching the ball have a pretty big advantage over the guys who are trying to stop them from catching it.
And I think that's true of pass rushers versus offensive linemen, too. I had Scott Turner said this to me once, the QB coach of the Panthers. He put it so concisely. He said, look, in the NFL, the receivers are better than the cornerbacks, and the pass rushers are better than the pass blockers. And that's the game, and who can win within that context. And I think he's exactly right. It kind of reshaped the way, it crystallized the way I view this stuff. And what's the common thread between cornerbacks and pass blockers is they're the reactors, and receivers and pass rushers, they're the proactive players. So you have to react to those guys, and it's harder to be a reactionary athlete than a proactive athlete.
That's the aggression. That's where the aggressors come in at this point. I think it goes back to last year's Super Bowl. I thought last year's Super Bowl was similar to this game. It's just that the defense didn't make plays sprinkled in. That's why he didn't have quite as many points. The Eagles certainly had a better defense than either of the teams you saw Monday night. Patriots are not terrible defensively. They maybe fell somewhere in between the Monday night teams and what the Eagles were last year. But you saw in last year's Super Bowl, you saw two offenses that really couldn't be stopped, and how they essentially just put their foot on the gas and defenses couldn't do anything about it. And then eventually Brandon Graham makes a play, and that's how the game ends.
And nobody said, oh, well, what's wrong with it? It's bad for football. What happened to defense? Nobody said that like they have after this game. And the reason why is what you just said, because in that Super Bowl, the defense didn't make the plays that they did in this game. So the score didn't get inflated.
So it was 41-33 instead of 54-51. One other point, not a more specific point, I just want to make off of that Monday night game, and this is gonna sound a little bit dumb in a vacuum, but Tyreek Hill, man, I really thought Travis Kelce was their best non-quarterback for basically all last season and most of this season, but Tyreek Hill is invaluable to that team. I mean, he terrifies defenses.
As he should. The whole you can't teach speed thing is very true. And imagine being the reactor to a guy with that kind of speed. And the other part is Tyreek Hill has evolved into a quality all-around receiver. His route running is good. A big part of having speed is also having the ability to withdraw your speed, to control it, to throttle down. And the best speed receivers outside, Brandon Cooks, Antonio Brown, these guys also have the ability to decelerate and get in and out of their breaks. And that's where Tyreek Hill has really flourished. He can get fast really fast, and he can get slow really fast. And he also catches what you throw him, which is surprising because I guess he doesn't have very big hands, and that was a concern about him. But he plays like a man with big hands. He's a ball plucker. He doesn't wait for the ball to come to him.
He is, I'll just say, he's in the right system and he has the right quarterback. So obviously that helps this whole conversation about Tyreek Hill. But there was that one play, I think it was in the second quarter on Monday night. He caught a ball in front of Sam Shields about maybe 4 or 5 yards downfield, and Sam Shields was terrified to attempt to tackle him for fear of Tyreek Hill was going to step out of it and just run 80 yards. So he sort of feebly kind of semi-escorted him toward the sideline, and a 4-yard gain turned into like a 12-yard gain. And that was sort of a microcosm of the nightmare it must be to try to guard Tyreek Hill, specifically for a guy like Sam Shields, who has been, you know, kind of on the back nine of his career at this point. And that was kind of unfair. Yeah. what Tyreek was doing to him on Monday.
I was surprised that they moved Shields into the starting lineup. He'd only been playing in dime packages this season, which means they do view him as a good pass defender. You don't see a cornerback sub in as a number two guy in dime very often. But they moved him into the starting lineup because they felt he's their fastest guy, and that's our best shot against Tyreek Hill. I was a little surprised they did that. But if he is your fastest guy, and I'm sure he is, then that's your only option too.
Yeah. Yeah, last point I'll make about that game is yes, there's going to be a lot of high-scoring games. There will not be, you know, we're not going to see 8 games like this every week. I think people also lost track of the fact that, you know, Jared Goff was the number one overall pick, and Patrick Mahomes, certainly if you redrafted that draft, I think he'd go number one overall. He was a number 10 pick, and there were a lot of people in the league who thought he might even go inside the top 10. So, I mean, these are two exceedingly talented teams, and therefore they are able to do that more than, say, maybe a Jacksonville Jaguars could go out and do that. I mean, we saw the Jaguars fall behind the Chiefs in Kansas City earlier this year, and when they tried to do the punch counter punch type of thing when they had to, they couldn't keep up. That's how it goes.
There's one fascinating, I know we're talking a lot about Rams Chiefs when they're on a bye this week, but there's one fascinating difference between Goff and Mahomes to me, and it's the reason Mahomes has the much higher ceiling, is Goff needs his legs with his arm to work in order to make the throw, which is how almost every QB is.
Yep.
Mahomes is in that very rare class of guys who doesn't. Guys who don't, rather. And Aaron Rodgers is in that class, too. Mm-hmm. The guys that just have the arm, and it's incredible. Mahomes, if I were starting a team now, I think I'd still go Carson Wentz, but I would struggle with that because Mahomes is so high on my list right now.
Yeah. No, he the things he does are biomechanically impossible is how I would describe it. Well, let's go to the next question from Dan, because it is a Mahomes-centric. It's actually a Mahomes and Aaron Rodgers-centric question. Dan is referring back to a question he had asked last spring. Would Andy's opinion on sitting highly drafted QBs for a year or so shift if Patrick Mahomes became a sensation similar to Aaron Rodgers, now that we've seen what happened? And I know your point, Andy, is more that it's what happens. It's not necessarily should they or shouldn't they, but it's what happens with all the rookie quarterbacks. No one sits their rookie quarterbacks anymore. Do you see the shifting again? I say again, I mean, rookie quarterbacks are, or excuse me, rookie contracts are different now with these quarterbacks, so that's part of what gives some urgency to putting them on the field. But do you think teams are going to be more open to doing the redshirt years with some of these guys?
I don't think so. I think we'll hear more about it, and teams will say we are, and they'll cite Mahomes. But what Mahomes went to a team that was ready to win now. The Chiefs traded up to get Mahomes. So they were a playoff-caliber team with a steady, sturdy head coach and who's not worried about getting fired tomorrow. Packers had Brett Favre, so no one was getting fired when he was there. So let's say QBs went into those situations more, and then we'd absolutely see them develop from the bench, and I would support that. That's not the reality, though. That's not, you can't sit here and tell Josh McDermott, for example,
Sean McDermott,
you can't tell him, hey, sit Josh Allen because Patrick Mahomes did well from the bench and Allen might develop better that way. Yeah, Allen might, but the Bills are going to get killed in the meantime. So the rest of the team's not benefiting from that. I don't think it's going to work out that. I understand the merit of it, but I don't think the realities of pro football and the teams that have rookie QBs are the ones that were bad the year before. That's why the rookie QB gets drafted high and is there. I just don't see enough scenarios where it's going to change much. Guys are going to play. Young QBs play. And also, Gary, we don't know that Mahomes is great because he sat out either. We just compared him to Jared Goff, who got killed his rookie year, and no one's saying that ruined him. So this is all just hindsight, access to the results analysis. Mahomes, how do we know he wouldn't have been even better if he had gotten real game reps last season?
We do not. That is a very good point. We don't know if there is causation here between the sitting and then reaching stardom. There's just a whole lot of guys. In my mind, there's just a whole lot of guys who sat early in their career and ended up becoming superstars, and they're scattered throughout the league. I think you gotta have a little patience with your rookie QB is my philosophy for my team that doesn't exist.
No, and I agree with that, but it raises the question: if we're gonna have patience, what does that mean? Because you can be patient by playing the guy and running a watered-down version of your offense and bringing him along slowly. And there's an argument to be made that that's a better way to develop a QB than to just not play him at all and then wait for him to learn the whole offense and then put him in there. I mean, this is all just philosophy. There's no right or wrong. And by the way, it varies from guy to guy. Some guys might be better sitting and learning from the sideline. Other guys are more kinetic learners. They're better from playing and experiencing the highs and lows. There's no one way to do this, and which is why we're going to have this conversation in every direction every year for the rest of our lives.
That is true. No, I do think guys who need to revamp their mechanics, I think those guys have to be on the sideline. I don't think you can do that in live action. I think you just you naturally go back to the old muscle memory, which is what you're comfortable with when you get into uncomfortable situations. But yeah. I mean, it's a good point. It also, you know, I wonder if we're going to see sort of a healthier market for bridge-type quarterbacks going forward. I don't know if that's the approach teams take. But yeah. One more question here, Andy. This one's kind of random, but I like this one because I do find myself thinking about it constantly during games. This is from Brendan. I figure that NFL teams think it's harder to move the ball within the red zone, more defenders in a condensed space. So following on that idea, would teams prefer having the ball first and 10 from the opponent's 15 instead of first and goal from the 10? I'll throw a couple of numbers because I just find myself making mental notes whenever I see a first and goal from the 8 or the 9 or the 10-yard line and thinking like, that's not a... I mean, yes, it's first and goal, and that's good, but that's not a great spot. The only splits I could pull out of this is off StatSync, our provider at SI. Goal to go from the 5 or closer over the past 5 years, that is a touchdown, 80.7, so just over 80% of the time. Goal to go from the 6 to 10 yard line, that is a touchdown, 59.5% of the time in the last 5 years. So you're talking 80% versus 60%. And the other point I'd throw out this scenario as maybe gaming the system a little bit more. If you're a defense and the opponent has a second and short from like the 14-yard line, do you just jump off sides? Do you give them that 5 yards to set up the long first and goal? Because second and short, second and 3 or less, typically you're going to have a first down eventually on that play or the next play a little more than 80% of the time.
So I don't think you would just jump off sides and concede it. I think what you might do is tell your D lineman you've got more freedom here to be aggressive coming off the snap. There's more margin for error.
Okay. I would...
Why wouldn't you do that and try to create third and 2 or third and 3 if it's second? Try to get a negative play rather than jumping off side. You don't want to train guys to do that either.
What if you jump off sides and end up giving them the free play? Then that's a problem too. I'm just jumping off sides. I'm telling all 11 guys, just line them up and just hit the guy in front of you way too early.
Well, let's talk about that. How should you jump off sides? If we're having everybody just nail every offensive lineman at the snap, you know what? That might have that you would get it's total bush league and you'd have an issue with the league at some point.
I'm not
but
not
think if you're
I
think about
that.
This though. if you're an offensive lineman and you know and you see it on film and you know there's a possibility that all five of these guys across from us are just going to say screw it and come running full steam at us and give us a blow-up shot at some point and we don't know when it's coming, that might make you play a little differently snap to snap, you know? If you know when you're like, if you jump out from behind a corner at somebody and you spook them, they go around corners differently for the next couple days.
Yeah, I guess there's something to be said for that. I would not do that. I don't have a team to do it with anyway, but I wouldn't do that because you're right. It is Bush League.
The other thing
I'm just saying, I would rather face a team first and goal from the 9 or 10. And then second and short from that sort of 13, 14, 15-yard line. I think that plays more in your favor.
All right, I'm going to scale the intellect back of this conversation because I don't know if I'll remember to think of it again. And I don't think we have any games scheduled for snow this weekend, but we're getting about that time of year. I wondered this last year in the Bills-Colts game, and I put it on Twitter, which was stupid because it gets isolated and then people get on you for thinking
this way. Why do you put anything on Twitter ever? Stop putting anything on Twitter.
I feel like I'm supposed to. Like it's the, I know. But let's say it's a snowy game. If you're a cornerback, what's to stop you from picking up a handful of snow, getting in press position, and then just flushing the snow into the face of the wide receiver at the snap? It's not illegal contact. It's not a personal foul. It's not taunting. It's not unnecessary roughness. What would happen if somebody did that?
I think it would fall under unsportsmanlike conduct. I think you would get flagged for it.
It's live action, though. Unsportsmanlike is a dead ball foul.
I still think that's I'm trying to think what else you could do.
Well, you know what it might be?
Snow weather.
If,
I mean,
you know,
spit on a guy, could you spit in a guy's face like at the snap?
That would be much easier to get away with than a handful of snow that you just throw in his face. It might be chalked up as, what do they call it? Like, how do they label the violation when a D lineman is calling out the signals at the line of scrimmage, the cadence? Because you're not allowed to do that. And if they catch you, it would fall under that umbrella. I bet it wouldn't the first time, though. I bet an official wouldn't believe what he saw. So if it's 3rd and 12 and it's snowy, I might throw the snow in the guy's face and dare the official to figure that one out.
Can I tell you, because I was watching this, I was watching this play the other day, the old Leon Lett Christmas Day 1993 Dolphins play where he
touched
the
day,
block field goal. I just call it Christmas? So Doug Peterson was the holder in that game for the Dolphins, and Dick Enberg and Bob Trumpy were the commentators, and they kept on pointing out how Peterson was furiously trying to clear off a spot for Pete Stojanovic to kick from during this whole melee, and you know, basically, you know, trying to clear the ice out of there so his kicker had some footing there. Elvis Patterson, the old veteran there, who I believe was in his last season at that point, during the delay, started grabbing snow and throwing it back into the spot to try to, which I guess is the soccer equivalent to scuffing up the penalty mark and stuff like that. But I thought that was pretty ingenious
brilliant.
By Elvis Patterson.
That's brilliant. Yeah, because there's no rule against that either. That is, I love that.
That whole thing is just one of my favorite Thanksgiving moments ever.
Well, just seeing the snow on Texas Stadium Field. Was something
awesome.
Else.
Yeah. Well, that's going to do it. We're going to talk a whole lot more red zone next year, Andy. I'm going
to
make you just deep dive.
I'll have to
red
study
zone
it. I'm getting sick of these red zone conversations, to be honest with you. But I acknowledge it's important.
It's so important.
Red zone matters. Yeah.
It's so important. That's going to wrap it for this show. Thanks to our researchers, Reed Foster and Ryan Taylor, who make us sound smart every week. And thank you, as always, to our producer, Shelby Royston, who makes us sound good. All the guys at Canes 13 who help us out so much with this show. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB Deep Dive NFL Podcast. You are the best. Andy and I will be back in your feed first thing Monday morning, regular week next week. So we'll be back Monday. Again on Thursday with the Deep Dive Show. Send those mailbag questions if you have them Albert Breer, Jenny Brentz's Connor Orr will be back on Wednesday, though they were Wednesday this past week too. And the Gambling Show goes back to its usual Friday spot. That is myself, Jimmy Trina, and Scott Gramling. So we ask that you subscribe to the MMQB Podcast Network wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Radio.com, and other podcast providers. We'll see you guys on Monday morning.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.